Just a quick note about this podcast. It is in two parts. Part one is live. It's a recording of something that happened at the table on this date. Part two is recorded after the fact because the device we were using for recording the live part failed partway through, and so we didn't capture the whole thing. But it's based on the same material, and aside from the sort of extemporaneous, spontaneous parts of sharing ideas in a community, the content is the same. So if you were there and you're listening to the podcast for some reason, why would one do such a thing? But if you are and you're like, wait a minute, that's not exactly the same, or if you notice that the sound changes halfway through, that's why. All right, so with that said, away we go.
I was reminded this past week that one of the wonders of winter is that it is not permanent. That sounds like a little, kind of like a passive-aggressive statement about winter. I was reminded of that because I had to remove a frozen deck that was upside down, so flat side down on part of our property. I had to get it off that surface, and it was thoroughly frozen on there to such a degree that when I pried it up, some of the planks that were spiked to the framework actually stayed behind. They were still frozen to the ground. And I was looking at that and I was thinking, the reason I'm picking this up is so in the spring, this chunk of grass won't remain dead. It'll grow. How improbable is all of this? That anything not just would come from this sheet of ice, you know, again. But it does. It does over and over again. At this time of the year, it feels counterintuitive. And that got me thinking. I mean, how hard do you have to think when you're heaving around frozen decks? You've got lots of time to think, you know. Believing something like winter is not permanent, I think, requires a kind of complex interaction of history and memory and faith. So one way to think about that is to think, well, history is spring comes every year. Memory is I can remember it happening. Faith is I believe it'll happen again. So this kind of requires all these pieces, right, to kind of go, yeah, well, it's not going to last forever. That last part, I believe it'll happen again, I think that can be the trickiest. They went on to say, it is more severe than anticipated, threatening natural ecosystems and the fate of humanity. It went on to say that the world's people face, quote, untold suffering due to the climate crisis, close quote. That's the kind of statement whose vagueness and sweeping scope and drama made it an irresistible soundbite. So that was the headline, right? Humanity faces untold suffering. Just to be clear, in a personal sense, I find the overwhelming scientific consensus regarding climate change very convincing. I don't think we're talking about some sort of conspiracy. I personally believe that we desperately need to implement changes on every level if we want to use the same powers of influence that got us into this mess to ameliorate the impact of it. And I think that's true in a whole bunch of ways, including the overall health of our home, the Earth. And so I think that messages like that one from that community of scientists, I think that messages that attempt to get our attention on matters like this are important. I think those messages are even essential. That said, they may not come with corresponding equipping for how to live well with the fears that they can provoke. So we can easily end up having the experience of feeling overwhelmed and helpless. And that isn't very productive, by which I do not mean profitable. I just mean that doesn't accomplish very much. Because most of us are not motivated by feeling helpless. When we feel helpless, one of our kind of hardwired reactions is to find a sheltered place where we can curl up in a ball and get ready to die. Perhaps we could think of it as a bit ironic that that's a natural response when it seems like it's almost diametrically opposed to the needed response, which is positive action. Of course, the other side of that curl up in a ball to die idea in terms of natural responses is that we would fight. And I think that's one of the ways that helps me, that idea is one of the ways that helps me feel a little more empathetic to the people who deny the possibility of something like climate change. I'm in no position to judge their motive, but it strikes me as also a natural reaction. It's one of lashing out, also not productive. I believe that spring is going to come is an essential part of believing winter is not permanent. It's hard to have one of those without the other. That said again, I believe that spring is going to come is not some sort of guarantee about what spring's going to be like. It doesn't mean that it's going to be warmer today when I go outside, right? So if we frame the problem as there's this piece and there's that piece, right now it's winter, but spring is going to come, it might help us to see that there's this big chunk missing from our way of thinking when we take a complex problem and we turn it into an either-or. Instead of engaging in this more complex, but I think also more helpful approach of both and. So last week in the talky bit, we were exploring some of our longings for home and how it's important to recognize that whatever stirs up the power of love in our lives can help us to be more attentive to the mysterious presence of the divine in everyday life, to be more aware of the ways in which what we are longing for is already present. And I suggested that this is the case even if what stirs up that longing might be something truly difficult, like loss or fear of loss. And I made an attempt in that talky bit to connect that to the season of Advent, to a time of the year when we might choose to focus our attention on longing for something new to be born or something hopeful or fresh to come into the story, sort of like spring comes after winter. That's all fine and good, but I think it can also end up tilting us toward a space that is sort of missing what I would call the earthy middle. Sort of like how believing that spring is going to come might not actually get us outside and engaged in something healthy in the winter, right? And I feel like I see this missing earthy middle in a lot of the versions of Christianity that I grew up around. I'm going to paint with a very broad brush here. I also saw many good things in those versions of Christianity. But here I saw and experienced a consistent problem. And it kind of got framed like this. Everything has fallen. Everything is corrupted. Everything is basically slated for destruction in terms of here and now. That's kind of like the it's winter message, okay? But God is going to someday make everything new. That's kind of like the but spring will come message. But in the meantime, what to do? Well, we could just take that hope for a someday solution. We could call it right belief. We could hold it tight. We could kind of face inward. We could gather in a bit of a religious huddle while we wait for something good to happen, or at least for the end of this suffering to come. That's a possibility. Or we could recognize in that way of thinking the deep inherent danger of a belief system that doesn't actually believe that the divine is present here and now. In the deeply earthy reality of daily life, except maybe as some sort of exception, but that exception has to be summoned by either right belief or by religious fervor and ritual. And if you don't think, if you grew up Protestant / evangelical, maybe uniquely, if you don't think you grew up around religious ritual, it probably means you haven't thought about the nature of ritual very much. Just think about the shape of what the music industry likes to call worship songs for a moment, and how many of them have as their core idea pleading that God would be please be present. Please. I know we're wretches, I know we're the problem, but could you show up anyway? You know, just this once? Then we'll do the ritual again next week and see if we can summon you again. Ritual. But the messy, earthy middle is where we live. It's where we decide how we're going to act, even if what we're experiencing personally is the kind of frozen ground that makes it hard to believe that spring will ever come, or the kind of anxiety that makes us want to gather around manufactured certainties, or that just might make us want to curl up in the fetal position and just wait for somebody else to do something about the problem. I've said this before, but I think it bears repeating. When I talk about curling up and giving up, I'm talking about things we might do when we have the capacity to choose. I'm not talking about the experience of mental illness or disordered anxiety of the magnitude that might strip us of those abilities. I am not saying, why are you not leaping for joy to the person whose mobility is limited? I acknowledge that this is very complicated terrain, and I feel deeply the possibility of a hurtful misstep. And so I feel like the best option open to me is just to be open about that. Maybe I should just ask for forgiveness in advance.
I also don't want to be reluctant to face the challenge of doing what we can with what we have. And I want to acknowledge that this is different for each of us. And it's even different for any one of us on any given day. Now, having said that, let's get back to the earthy middle, to that terrain of both and. My hope is that some of what we're going to explore here shortly will offer something that most of us find accessible much of the time. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of hearing Zoe Matties talk about how self-care is also care for creation. Zoe is the program manager for Arosha, which is a Christian environmental organization. And what they do is they engage communities in the conservation of nature. And they do that through community-based conservation projects, through ecological monitoring and research, and through environmental and theological education. Arosha has field stations and site-based projects in 20 countries around the world, and it's in the process of developing one here in Manitoba, a project that in no small part is given leadership by Zoe. Zoe strikes me as having wisdom beyond her years. Her presentation on this topic was a moving combination of thoughtful and passionate, fact and feeling, deliberation, and a sort of a gentle, empathetic call to action. But it was also pretty clear. And it felt to me like it was very much about what we've been considering today, this space in which we might feel like giving up or huddling up or lashing out. But we know that if being healthy people with a healthy earth home is something we desire, we must not do so. So, with a huge thank you to Zoe for being willing to freely share her ideas with me, I want to spend the balance of this time considering some very practical ways we might get unfrozen if we find ourselves feeling immobilized by fear-filled messages about our home, the earth. And I'm going to quite deliberately frame these as practices, things we actually do, things that we have to do more than once to probably feel comfortable with them. They take some repetition to learn. But once we learn them and we take them into our bodies and into our enacted lives, our lived experiences, they're things that can help us both care well for ourselves and for our home now, and that can keep us strong to care going forward. We've talked a fair bit about this first practice at other times, but I think it's an important starting point in what we're going to talk about for the balance of this morning. If we want to care well for ourselves and for the earth, we need to start by grounding ourselves in gratitude. Diana Butler Bass, whose newest book, Grounded, is well worth reading if you're interested in sort of a post-religious Christian perspective on a spirituality that's all about earthiness, is also the author of a book called Grateful. And in that book she writes, quote, "In difficult times, gratitude can make us stronger and more able to face personal challenges and work on behalf of the common good." So, not just deal with our own lives well, but also contribute to the wellness of the life of all. Gratitude isn't about thinking only positive thoughts. It's easy to misunderstand it that way. It's also not just about shoving away negative feelings. It's not about repressing something. The very intriguing author and activist Joanna Macy says that gratitude is not dependent on our external circumstances. It doesn't depend on whether we like where we are or whether we approve of what we're facing. It can coexist with our concerns. It can even coexist with our grief for the world. More on grief in a moment. Most folks that take the practice of gratitude seriously will say that it's not just a feeling, but something we do. Gratitude is something that comes into being when we cultivate an awareness of the gifts that are around us every day, and we make it a habit to be thankful for them. Now, we're constantly bombarded with messages that are intended to make us feel dissatisfied with who we are and what we don't have, or with what we do have, for that matter. Want to do something to subvert that message, to undermine it? Enact gratitude. Gratitude assails the message of dissatisfaction. It promotes well-being for us, well-being for those around us, and well-being for the whole of creation. The second practice is to let ourselves feel grief. Now, this might seem a little bit less obvious, but it's something we've already explored in other ways in this setting. To be human is to feel grief. And there is no ducking that reality. We can choose to deny it. We can choose to blunt it. We can try to end run it with all sorts of things. But if we refuse to feel grief, we will not be growing our capacity to feel in general, which in turn inhibits our ability to feel deeply about such fundamentals as the well-being of the planet. We're just truncating our feeling capacity when we do that. Wally so beautifully and courageously took us deep into this reality a couple of weeks ago when he told his own stories about grief and loss and how those inform his present-day care for others and for creation, and how that connects to the ancient indigenous ways that are his practice. Every once in a while, when I experience an indigenous person's wisdom, and then in close proximity I encounter wisdom from someone in the European tradition or the settler tradition that's my heritage, every once in a while I feel like a little glimmer of hope that maybe us white folks are starting to catch on. The next person I want to reference is not from an indigenous tradition, but is obviously aware of some of that wisdom, a psychotherapist named Francis Weller. And Weller writes, "Sorrow helps us remember something long intuited by indigenous people across the planet, that our lives are intricately commingled with one another, with animals, plants, watersheds, and soil." Weller goes on to say that we all must undertake an apprenticeship with sorrow. How about that? An apprenticeship with sorrow. And that this is a skill and practice that we must develop. He writes, "Our personal experiences of loss and suffering are now bound inextricably with dying coral reefs, melting polar caps, the silencing of languages, the collapse of democracy, and the fading of civilization. The personal and the planetary are inseparable, as is our healing." Now, you might choose to take exception to some of the examples of that inextricable intertwinedness. Perhaps you don't think about the collapse of democracy as synonymous with the fading of civilization. I don't know. But the point that Weller is making, I think, is one we should take in. Grieving demonstrates that we care about something, and that we are connected to something beyond ourselves. It's an expression of gratitude and love, and it takes both courage and practice. And the wisdom of Jesus speaks to this when he tells the people that they are blessed if they mourn. And in a culture that's like, no, if blessed means you're living a good life, you're blessed if you don't have anything you need to mourn. And Jesus says something so profoundly different than that. Blessed are those that mourn. And I think what Jesus is meaning, in part, is that if we have something to grieve, it means that we care about something that is bigger than ourselves. And that can include climate grief. That can include mourning the damage done and the loss to come as an expression of love. And what we love, we work to protect. It's how we're wired. And if you think that's just a bumper sticker truism, just, you know, get between a mama bear and her cub, either literally or, you know, kind of categorically. Actually, maybe you better not. Let's just take that as a given, if we can. There's lots more to explore there, but for now, let's move on. The third practice is to take a walk in the woods. There's been an explosion of research lately about how much this matters to us as human beings. The entire sort of forest bathing idea, which comes to us from a long-standing Japanese practice, is an interesting for instance. Going for a walk in the woods matters to us personally because in yet another example of science proving the obvious, lot of that current research basically says trees make us happy. Given how many harvested trees are around us in this holiday season, perhaps I should point out that living trees make us especially happy. Studies show that spending time in nature increases relaxation and decreases our pulse, depression, fatigue, anxiety, confusion. Anybody feel like that sounds like a good idea? I think it also matters in wider ways, because going for a walk in the woods helps us get to know the particular places in which we live. And that matters because we care for what we know. Stephen Bama Prediger, author of For the Beauty of the Earth, says it this way, quote, "We care only for what we love. We love only what we know. We truly know only what we experience. If we do not know our place, know it in more than a passing, cursory way, know it intimately and personally, then we are destined to use and abuse it." It can be overwhelming to think about caring for an entire planet, paralyzing, immobilizing. But we can much more readily grasp what our part might be in caring for our particular place on this planet. The fourth practice is to get around in some way other than with our car whenever we can. Now, I appreciate that this is a message that hinges on a point of privilege. I'm grateful to have a car. In this season in particular, I appreciate the relative shelter and warmth that it provides. I know that even in this community, there are people that walk because they have no choice in the matter. So an idea like this might just sound like utter nonsense in that context. But for many of us, much of the time, we would benefit both in terms of personal health and in terms of planetary health by choosing to walk or bike whenever possible. Now, I'm not some kind of tower of virtue on this one, but I can tell you from the experience of commuting by bike to work year-round here in Winnipeg for about 15 years, that it's not only possible, but it's enlivening, to put it gently, at least in the winter, and that I really miss it when it's not feasible to do so. It's such an ordinary thing to do, walk or ride a bike, and yet it's so transformative. Not available as an option for all of us, but when it is, well worth considering. The fifth practice is to take time away from social media to personally connect with others and with spirit. There's lots of different ways we can do this. We can keep silence, we can meditate, we can engage in deliberate human-to-human conversation. We can even think about getting back to an idea like the ancient practice of Sabbath, the word that just means stop, by choosing not to do something because that's good for us. What does that have to do with dialing down our social media interactions? By the way, this is not an anti-technology screed. I think our devices can be important and powerful tools. They can be really great servants, but I also believe that they make truly awful masters. And if we wonder about that, all we need to do is look at the explosion of detox camps for people and their devices. Anyway, choosing to step away from social media can help us see that, and it can help us develop the kind of personal resiliency that equips us to not get immobilized by this reactionary social media news cycle. I'm not even sure that I think news cycle is a good descriptive term anymore. I mean, something never slows down or pauses or kind of changes its trajectory in any distinguishable way. Is it still a cycle? Because it feels like that's how this delivery of information in social media as a news outlet behaves. It just is constantly coming at us. And we need to stand back, because standing back is how we learn to pay attention. This is what we were exploring last week, being attentive as a way of pushing back on huge assumptions about things like consumption and growth as an inevitable, for instance. Now, the poet Mary Oliver, who passed away earlier this year, wrote lots of poems about her experiences with the natural world. She lived a profoundly simple life. She took long walks through the woods and along the shore nearly every day. She practiced the art of paying attention. And in her Instructions for Living a Life, she wrote, "Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it." This is also the person who wrote, "Attention is the beginning of devotion." So, if you can imagine that there is something that you wish to be devoted to, if there is more than meets the eye that you wish to be devoted to, attention is the beginning of devotion. Oh, you keep going, but I want to kind of get to the hands-on part that I promised. What we're going to do together, and if you're listening to this on the podcast, you can choose your own way to do this if you wish. I think that would be time well spent. But what we're going to share together here in community this morning is called the Stone Ritual. It's a way of getting unstuck, among other things, of moving with our whole self, body, mind, and spirit into terrain that we might not frequent. It's a safe way of giving voice to some of what we might be feeling at a time like this, maybe because of winter, maybe because of the holidays, maybe because we're wrestling with what to do when 11,000 scientists tell us that the future of humanity is in jeopardy. We might be feeling things like anger or sorrow, emptiness, hope, gratitude. Whatever you're feeling is okay. All feelings welcome. Here, just behind me, I've got a clay bowl. It's filled with water. It's surrounded by stones. I invite you to pick one up and to speak aloud or in the silence of your heart a grief, a fear, an anger, a hope that you're feeling at this time. Any and all emotions are welcome. Hold that rock, and I can't help but think of Wally talking about the grandfather and grandmother stones, that these rocks, this collection of rocks, any rock, has seen and knows more than any of us possibly could. And to take that emotion and give it to the rock. Now, some of you right now are thinking, Tim, give my emotion to the rock. Think about it this way. If our lives are intertwined with earth and soil and water and air, what a rock is a compressed, particular expression of those things. Our emotions, our emotional life, the things that we feel about, that we care about, that we love, they're all shared with that earth, air, water reality as well. A handful of soil is actually, in scientific terms, as well as in metaphysical terms, is a microcosm of the universe. So when I say give your feelings to the stone, I'm not talking about giving your feelings to something inanimate. It might look that way to us, but that's because we're not using our imaginations very much. We're not even paying attention to our own science very well at that point. Give your feelings to the stone. Bring the stone up to the front. Put it into the water. As all of those emotions are gathered together in this bowl, we can know that these emotions of ours are being held collectively, that we are not alone. We have the company of others. And the earth and the water are holding us. After our gathering today, I'm going to take this bowl and this water, and we'll pour the water into a plant where it will nourish her and go back to the earth. Thank you for listening, for thinking about these things, for engaging. It's been good to be together. Peace.